Well, this time we look for the picture of God in the book called Numbers. At least in English it's called Numbers. In the Greek Septuagint, that's a Greek translation of the Old Testament, it's called Arithmoi. You can hear arithmetic in there. That's where the name Numbers came from. It was a little different in the Hebrew. Before we begin, by the way, I should tell you about a letter we received some time ago from the Falkland Islands, of all places, from a gentleman there who was listening to the tapes of a previous trip through. And he wanted to assure me that he always read the book in the Bible through before he listened to the tape. Now, that's very desirable, because the discussions are not a substitute for actually reading the book. As far as the general contents is concerned, you notice a number of the versions of the Bible have very nice introductions and summaries at the beginning. In my Good News Bible, there's a very neat one, and I've checked many other versions, and, well, even in the Old King James, and these did change through the years, there were summary statements at the top of each page. Now, those were not part of the original books of the Bible, but comments of the printers and the editors and translators. Like for Numbers, Good News has, the book of Numbers tells the story of the Israelites during the nearly 40 years from the time they left Mount Sinai until they reached the eastern border of the land that God had promised to give them. The name of the book refers to a prominent feature of the story, that is, the census, which Moses took of the Israelites at Mount Sinai before their departure, and again in Moab, east of the Jordan, about a generation later. In the period between the two censuses, the Israelites went to Kadesh Barnea on the southern border of Canaan, but failed to enter the promised land from there. After spending many years in that area, they went to the region east of the Jordan River, where part of the people settled and where the rest prepared to cross the river into Canaan. It's an excellent historical survey there. So the book of Numbers is an account of a people who were often discouraged and afraid in the face of hardship and who rebelled against Moses and against God and so on. And the stories follow. There are also many excellent books that give short summaries of the contents. I, through the years, have picked up dozens of books that seek to present the general contents of each of the 66 books. And some of them are in outline form. And in my classes, I must have distributed hundreds, maybe even thousands of these. And they're very, very useful. But the main thing for us, of course, is what picture of God do you see in this record? During these 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, many strange experiences were met by the children of Abraham, and they also picked up a few more rules and regulations and ceremonies. For example, there's the extraordinary test for jealousy. If you think your wife has not been faithful, according to Numbers 5:11, you can give her a special potion to drink, and she will react in a certain way. And I was wondering, Bob, if you would ever think, not that you, of course, would never need to, but would you use such? would you be tempted to try?
No, but there must have been a problem, or it wouldn't have been put out in the permanent record for them to have to fall back on. My question would be, yes. Did it work?
Do we have any record of it being used?
Not that I know of, in the Bible at least.
I've enjoyed particularly reading Jewish commentators on these matters. My favorite commentary on the first five books in the Bible is one written by a gentleman who was once the chief rabbi of the British Empire. His name was Rabbi J.H. Hertz. I probably wouldn't have these volumes except for the attempt years ago to pass through the League of Nations. That followed World War I, you remember. After World War II, it's been the United Nations, the League of Nations in Geneva. There was an attempt there to change the world calendar. And had the world calendar been changed, the seventh-day Sabbath, which means so much to the Orthodox Jews and conservative Jews, would have passed through the week. It would have been Monday next year, Tuesday the next year, and so on. The rabbi came to our house to visit my father, who was quite a persuasive speaker. And he asked if my father would be willing to represent the position of the Jews at the League of Nations. So I remember when this rabbi came to the door, and he had a wonderfully coiffed beard, and I was solemnly introduced to him. It was around 1930, I believe. And he was so grateful, my father. I have copies of the speeches he made at the League of Nations against a rotating calendar. He was in favor of leaving the week, as it has been traditionally. And it was voted down at the time, and he did this again at a later time. And in appreciation, Chief Rabbi Hertz gave my father the 5 volumes of commentary on Genesis through Deuteronomy that he had prepared, with the Hebrew on the right side, the English translation on the left, and wonderful notes underneath. And it's interesting to see what he has to say about the test for jealousy and a number of other things coming up in Numbers and Deuteronomy, especially Deuteronomy, that we discuss next time. He said at least it would discourage a woman from fibbing on the subject because she certainly would not want to expose herself to this thing. But he still had many questions about it. We don't have a record of a specific case and of the specific results and so on that I know of.
I was just wondering if maybe God included that because at the time the practice might have been much harsher. If you suspected your wife, you simply, in one way or another, either divorced her or did worse. And this was at least a way to try to make the procedures more civil.
Under the prevailing circumstances at the time. It's true. By the way, I should perhaps mention for listeners, this commentary is called The Pentateuch and Haftorahs, edited by J.H. Hertz. You can get these 5 volumes now in one single volume. I just happen to have the original 5. When my father died 24 years ago, we children sat in a circle and sadly divided up his library. And when we came to these 5 books, since I had met the rabbi, I asked if my brothers and sisters would let me have these 5. So I still have them, and I'm going to bring them to our discussions on as today with Numbers and then later on Deuteronomy. Well, running through the rest of the book, we have more complaints against the manna and their preference for meat. In fact, just to set the mood for Numbers, look at Numbers 11. I'm using the Good News, as I notice, I think you all are this time. In Numbers 11, it begins, "The people began to complain to the Lord about their troubles." A very common phrase. "When the Lord heard them, he became angry and sent fire on the people," and so on. Then drop down to verse 4. "There were foreigners traveling with the Israelites. They had a strong craving for meat. And even the Israelites themselves began to complain, 'If only we could have some meat. In Egypt, we used to eat all the fish we wanted, and it cost us nothing. Remember the cucumbers, the watermelons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic we had. But now our strength is gone. There is nothing at all to eat, nothing but this manna day after day," and manna meaning what is it, except this what is it stuff day after day. And then it goes on to say manna was like small seeds, whitish-yellow in color. It fell on the camp at night along with the dew. The next morning the people would go around and gather it, grind it, or pound it into flour, and then boil it and make it into flat cakes. It tasted like bread baked with olive oil. Moses heard all the people complaining as they stood around in groups at the entrances of their tents. He was distressed because the Lord had become angry with them." Much mention of God's anger, which is a question that we ought to deal with. "And he said to the Lord, 'Why have you treated me so badly? Why are you displeased with me? Why have you given me the responsibility for all these people? I didn't create them or bring them to birth. Why should you ask me to act like a nurse and carry them in my arms like babies all the way to the land you promised to their ancestors? Where could I get enough meat for all these people? They keep whining and asking for meat. I can't be responsible for all these people by myself. It's too great for me. If you're going to treat me like this, have pity on me and kill me so that I won't have to endure your cruelty any longer." It doesn't sound very friendly or trusting. And yet, in the end, you know, Moses is treated so well, and he's put right there in Hebrews 11, you know, as one of God's trusting friends. The way God treats his friends so graciously, even though at times they have not behaved too well, reminds me of what this Rabbi Hertz says about Sarah laughing. You remember when God said, "You're going to have a baby," and she laughed. And God said, "Why did you laugh?" "Oh," she said, I didn't laugh." But then a little later on, you remember, Abraham laughed. Well, I had to look that up and see what the rabbi would say. And he suggested that Abraham didn't laugh to show unbelief, of course. Abraham laughed because he was so happy. I don't know whether he was trying to spare Abraham. But if you read on further there in Exodus, when the baby was born, Sarah called his name, he laughs. That's what Isaac means. He laughs. And then a little later on, she says, God has given me laughter with this baby. And when anyone hears about my baby, they will laugh with me. So the laughter wasn't so bad when you stop to think of it. I mean, think how old Abraham was, and Sarah was 90. To be told that one is going to have a baby could make one laugh. And I really think the Lord was smiling at the same time. He certainly didn't hold it against them. It's true, God did say, is it too wonderful for you when I say you're going to have a baby? Well, later, Romans says that Abraham, he did take a good look at Sarah and at the condition of his own body and realized that it would take a miracle to have this baby. But it says in Romans that he gave glory to God as he thought about the fact that God had created everything out of nothing in the beginning, and surely the one who created could give them a baby. And so he did. However, Abraham's faith and Sarah's, it wasn't perfect, you remember? They tried to arrange for this through Hagar with very undesirable results. So there is an element of lack of complete trust, it's true. Though along with it, there is a little laughter because it, I mean, it really was incredible, wasn't it? It would make the television program what do they call this one? Amazing Facts, or It's Incredible. It really was. But the Lord certainly overlooked that. But when Moses talks like this, right after this, God talks about him being his special friend. So God was very sympathetic when the leader was so tired. And it's true, look how they were behaving. Then it goes on to tell about the quail that came later on, and we should look up the story in more detail a little further on, perhaps. This matter of being angry comes up so often. He's angry with Aaron and Miriam, but has a special relationship with Moses. We certainly should look at that. And then the story of the 12 spies and the reaction of the people. And so in chapter 13, God says, there's no way I could take you folk in. No one over 20 will enter except Caleb and Joshua. The rest of you will die here in the wilderness. And then in chapter 16, he swallows up Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And then to choose the Levites to supply the priests. The amazing story of Aaron's rod that budded, which would seem like an efficient method to conduct an election. Then the story of Moses smiting the rock. The people could go in, but Moses could not. Even though the people had said in chapter 14, they'd rather go back to Egypt. And yet God says, you can go in, but Moses cannot. And we must look at that. Then the story of Balaam is in here. And it's not so much the donkey, which is amazing enough, but his prayers to God. Once, no. Twice, no. Third time, yes. But I'll tell you what to say. And what he says is a prediction of the sign of Jesus' birth. But it's the way that story ends, with the slaughter of the Midianites, at which time Balaam was killed. And God's chosen people were told that after they'd killed all the soldiers, they could keep the girls for themselves. And you'd think you're right at some places in the world today. And then it ends with the story of Joshua, who takes over and leads them into the promised land. Well, remembering all those stories, what does that tell us about God? What does he seem to be trying to accomplish here during these 40 years? And does he seem to be enjoying any success at all? Remembering that all God asks is trust. He had trust once before the war began, and there was peace and security and happiness. Now he's trying to win those who have rebelled against him to come back and trust him, and to confirm the trust of those who have agreed to stay with him. And in the Old Testament, we have the evidence that God can be trusted. And though not everyone has read the Old Testament record, surely the universe looking on has not just read the record, they have watched, or certainly received live reports of everything that has gone on. They saw the war begin. They saw one-third of their neighbors and friends side with the adversary against God, and they are watching these events, and it's getting clearer by the minute. Do you think, as they watched? If so, what would you pick out? In fact, taking all 66 books, Has this really clarified things for the onlooking universe? Or thinking of last time, the tabernacle, with all the sacrifice of animals. As each animal was sacrificed, as each pigeon was killed, did the angel say, that is getting clearer by the minute? And they watched God choose Abraham. And they watched the descendants of Abraham. Now they trust God so little, he has to let a whole generation die off in the wilderness. Do you think the angels might have... It seems they're free to raise questions. If they knew God well, would they dare go to God and say, why did you pick Abraham? Now, maybe, God, you've been surprised by the way things have worked out. But for those of us who understand from Scripture that God has foreknowledge, the past, the present, and the future are all alike to him, did you know the children of Abraham, your friend, were going to behave like this? If so, why did you pick him? A very fundamental question, which is often raised. Yes.
It would be interesting if we could read an angel's account of watching this, because then what does angry mean? Would an angel who is up there with God describe God as being angry? Or was this Moses's word? What's the original word mean? What was Moses trying to convey? Was he conveying human terms? Or did he actually think God was angry?
Yeah, good place to start. It's mentioned so often in the Bible, the anger or the wrath of God. We don't use wrath much now. It's the same word in the original. The 66th book, which you think would have the clearest picture, it's the summation picture in the whole Bible, talks about God pouring out his anger and wrath without mixture and so on. Do you think that if a child, children often raise this question, why does God always seem so angry? He's much angrier than daddy is, you know, gets angry once in a while. But God often seems so angry. I've had medical students raise this in class. I remember particularly one time, we had got about this far in the Bible, and a student who had never read the Bible through before said, I'm really quite surprised at what I'm reading. I thought my father was quite severe, but I knew God would be quite superior to that. He said, God's much more severe than my father ever was. And all I could say was, well, read on. It'll get worse before it gets better. Well, where would the solution be? And following your question, if a little child could go to an angel and say, please explain God's wrath, do you think the angels are clear enough on this that they could say, well, if you'll sit down, I'll explain? If so, what do you think the explanation would be?
It seems like we have to keep putting things back into human terms, because as a woman living in the United States today, I'm quite appalled at how it seems to always end up on the man's side throughout the Bible. It seems heavily favored and weighted in terms of the men. But
no, we haven't dealt with that yet, have we? It's true. That's true.
And yet, on the other hand, if I stop and think about the history throughout time, that wasn't God's fault. That was the way things were. So what he seemed to be dealing with were the customs and standards of the time, and probably trying to lift the people up and treat them better. So if we keep putting things in human terms, were these words Moses's trying to convey to the people that this was serious rather than God is angry as we think of anger?
That is such a worthwhile question. It could bring up many illustrations. For example, your first point about following the custom of the day with respect to seeming to favor the men. You'd think maybe by the New Testament things would improve.
But.
And yet when Jesus fed the 4,000 and the 5,000, it says, besides women and children, they were not numbered, I'm sorry to say. And in the censuses in the Old Testament, they counted the men. They didn't count the women. Some of these regulations about the relationships between the sexes don't seem very fair here, do they, in the Old Testament? But let's concentrate on anger for the moment. If a parent is trying to... first of all, advise a small child to stop doing something that's harmful, with little success, because the parent is a very kind parent with a very kind face and a very kind voice. And you simply cannot lead this child to take you very seriously when you say, now, if you do that one more time, you're going to get into serious trouble. Or you do that one more time, and mommy will be... well, if nothing else has worked, you find to say, mommy will be very cross with you. But when you say cross, don't smile and don't sound too tender, because the child cannot look up the word cross yet in the dictionary. The only way the child knows what cross means is the look on your face and the sound of your voice. And so you have to somehow steel yourself. Well, I found this difficult having three daughters. And they were all very skillful at this. In fact, my wife was sure that they took advantage of my being the daddy. And she'd send them up for discipline. They'd come back with chewing gum from my throat. But I assured her we did have some earnest words in between. My middle daughter particularly, at that time she had long pigtails, and she'd stand in front of me and put her hands behind her back and look so contrite. How could I say, you do that one more time, and I'll be very cross with you? Well, it was necessary at times to really mean it. And that meant I had to almost feel like a bully. Here's this little tiny child in front of me, you know. And I had to sound cross and look cross. And in a way, I wasn't. I mean, how could a big daddy look that way at a little girl? How could the infinitely powerful God of the universe look at us pygmies and get cross the way we do? But to get us to take him seriously, he talked the way we have to talk to each other. You do that one more time, and I will be very, very angry with you. And at times he even thundered those words. What do you think? Is that...
I think that makes logical sense. So then my next question is, since that makes logical sense, why do so many people take it out of context and act like God is angry all the time waiting to catch you? Because that is not what parents do. Good parents. And so why do we take it out of context in a situation, just like in a situation if your child runs out into the street? And as you look at the Israelites at this point in time, it was, so to speak, perhaps an emergency measure. So why do we pretend that God's this way all the time and we need to be afraid of him?
Oh, I think that's such a great question, and that brings many memories to my mind. I think at first we parents are like gods to our children. That is, if we profess to be believers in God, and they can't see God, but they can see us. I was very fortunate with my parents. My mother had a unique way of disciplining. In my book that I've mentioned, Servants of Friends, you will see a picture of a little boy sitting on the bottom stair waiting for repentance to come. Because my mother, when all else had failed, would trot me out to the entry to our house. And I would assume the proper posture, and mother made skillful use of a leather strap she kept in a drawer in the front entry. And she would discuss my crime to the rhythmical swinging of the strap. And so the more serious the crime, the longer it took mother to describe it, which was to my disadvantage, of course. And then she would not let us go out angry. We had to sit on the bottom step and wait for repentance to come. And when it did, we would go in and we'd hug mother and say we were sorry, and there'd be kisses, and when we could run out and play. And as I recall, my mother never was angry. I cannot recall my mother being angry. So when I read in several places in the Bible, whom the Lord loves, he disciplines for their best good, it wasn't difficult for me to understand how he could do that, because that's what my mother used to do. Not that I immediately perceived that or ever said to my mother, while I was still feeling rather warm in certain parts, thank you, mother, I needed that. I don't remember ever doing it. But when mother was dying, and she had Parkinson's, so she couldn't remember much and couldn't say much, she did remember way, way back. And it was quite a warm feeling a few years ago to go back and sit on that bottom stair as an adult and remember my mother. I'm very grateful that she helped me understand as a small boy that God could seem angry. I probably thought my mother was at the time. And he could discipline, if necessarily, quite severely, painfully, if need be, but for our best good, because he loved us. And then, of course, bringing up my own children and then watching the grandchildren, it works, doesn't it? So I think that as parents, we can greatly help the children understand the meaning of God's wrath. However, I would want more information from the rest of Scripture to be sure that I'm not reading our humanity back into God. I'd want evidence from God discussing this. And there are wonderful places coming up in the book of Hosea, where he says, you're bent on leaving me, there's nothing more I can do for you. But he cries, but how can I give you up? How can I let you go? My heart recoils within me, but I'm going to have to let you go. And many other places like that coming up. And then the statement, whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. So I'm afraid that some people who've grown up with parents who didn't represent God very well have made it very hard for the children to realize that God is more loving than their parents. So I think it's a great privilege for parents and teachers, too, to, at least in a limited human way, picture how God could indeed talk to us very, very seriously and even resort to whatever measures are appropriate and still love us and not be angry. Yes, Janie.
Well, it appears that all the people acted like very young children because he had to spell everything out to them.
In tiny detail.
Right, and it seems, when I read it, I think, well, shouldn't they know this? Shouldn't they know? But apparently they didn't, and he had to spell everything out to them, like you would to a small child.
Which, of course, is further evidence that they would need then to be taught to as small children. So that's good evidence. And that's, again, where books on customs and times back in those days are very, very helpful. And there are more and more on the market these days, and they're well illustrated and deserve a place in everybody's library who wants to understand the picture of God in Scripture. Oh, let's pick out something else. Speaking of anger, what about what he did to Korah, Dathan, and Abiram when they acted so rebelliously, that whole story? That would seem like a forceful way to move in on a crisis. Because if nothing had been done, the people were lining up behind those three influential men and their families. And so in due course of time, God acts very forthrightly, opens up the earth, and swallows them. Have you not thought when studying the history of the human race, there were a lot of other times when that would have been a very appropriate thing to happen? In fact, right now, as you put your finger on several spots on the map, wouldn't that be perfect in a few little spots? It would actually save a lot of lives. Leaders of a country who are very ambitious engage in very cruel destruction of neighboring countries. Why not have the earth swallow up those leaders? Because most of the people don't want to fight each other. Why doesn't God use this method? Yes.
I was just going to ask you, why doesn't he do that now?
No.
It would be so nice and clean and
yes.
quick.
Yes, so decisive. Sort of thing you would have you'd expect of one who has infinite power.
Someone else.
Yes. Well, what's the best procedure when one reads a story like this? I've always felt that the best thing is to read on, and as I've suggested, it can get worse. In Joshua coming up, you remember when there was an example of distrust in God before they went into Canaan, and Achan disobeyed the instructions. Both Achan and his wife and his children and his pets were all taken outside the camp, and they were stoned to death. I mean, there was no question about their actions displeasing God. And then you go on to the story of the She-Bears. We touched on these once before. When there was great irreverence in Israel, and the king of Israel was even consulting Beelzebub, the god of flies, God handled that irreverence in this very forceful manner. And, of course, thinking of Sinai, and then in the New Testament, Ananias and Sapphira. They cheated with their offering and died on the church floor. And you can be sure that the offerings were multiplied. You know, you think of all our churches that are in financial trouble these days. In fact, maybe our own government during this period of economic crisis, maybe this would be an easier solution to the one that's being debated in Congress at the present time. They say people cheat with their income tax. Why not use force to handle these matters? Why do you think God doesn't use the forceful method more frequently? Because he does use it from time to time. Incidentally, was there great reverence in Israel permanently after Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, after the She-Bears, after Sinai? You think anybody cheated with his offering after Ananias and Sapphira died on the church floor? It doesn't seem to last. And we're back to the flood and all, and Sodom and Gomorrah and all these other illustrations of where God has indeed shown his power, but it hasn't produced what he wants. For a little while, it causes people to offer him trembling submission, but he doesn't want that. You can't produce trust and peace and freedom by force. So later on, when we get to Zechariah, there's a wonderful verse, as you know, in Zechariah 4:6, where God says, not by might nor by power, but by the way the Spirit works is the only way in which I can get what I want. And as Jesus explained, the Spirit works with truth with evidence, with love. Well, then, if it doesn't produce good results, why does God use it at all from time to time?
Well, like the man who broke the Sabbath was stoned to death.
Yes.
It seems awfully harsh.
But if a pastor of a church is concerned about Sabbath observance, wouldn't it help if periodically, you know, someone in the church was selected and taken out into the garden outside the church and the members would stone him to death? I'm sure there would be silence in church. And then if someone died on the floor, the offerings would be adequate. I mean, it would seem efficient.
But it'd be a terrible way to live.
Yeah, would you want to live forever with a God who would use such methods? And yet, why does he use them at all, occasionally?
I have a trivia question, and I've seen this come up throughout the Bible, but in number 16, actually you could start in 29, but particularly 30, Moses starts out in verse 29 by saying, "If these men die a natural death without some punishment from God, then the Lord did not send me." But then he goes on to quite dramatic. Did God tell Moses that to destroy them in this manner, or did Moses decide and God just follows along? When something like that happens and God's obviously the one that is dealing with it, has he told his special
friends? Doesn't say
friends?
That, does it? It
no.
just said that he asked for some confirmation of his leadership, and God provided it. Would that mean if Moses had not asked him, God would have used some other method? Maybe just slap them on the wrist instead of swallowing them up. We have a number of stories. We have one coming up where it seems that because Moses pled with God, God repented of the evil he was going to do.
Right.
And isn't it lucky for the Israelites that Moses pled for them? And then the Lord did it. Do you wish he would do this more frequently?
Not really.
Sometimes.
No. But it's interesting that Well, at least it seems that it was an attention getter. I mean, maybe at least it subdued them momentarily long enough so that he could get through to some of them.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a logical reason for doing it. And then I guess you do sort of wonder why things were so different back then with be it the prophets, and yet we're told now, be so careful who you believe, and we're not ready to go follow prophets now when somebody rises up and says that they are one. It was different back then.
Well, this raises the larger question. I think last time, Jenny, you mentioned it. Why doesn't God use the methods of Leviticus? If they were good and they came from him back then, why not now? But, Connie, you've been suggesting that times have changed. Does that mean times have improved and God doesn't need to use these methods? People are so much kinder and more teachable. Well, again, it's the question of why did the Lord thunder on Sinai and weep gently on the Mount of Olives? Which method seemed to work better? How many did he win at Sinai? How many did he win on the Mount of Olives? Neither one seemed to work very well. Is the Lord, apparently, people have raised this question, is he apparently searching for some method that will really work and hasn't hit on it yet?
And you might want to ask, which way would he like to draw people to him?
Now, do we have any illustrations of that? Isn't that coming up right here in Numbers, the way he could talk to Moses?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel if at times, in fact, very frequently, an excellent question is raised, and we don't seem to be able to say, well, the answer, shuffling a few pages, is as follows, reading another text. So often one cannot come up with a quick answer.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean forget the question, though. That means, and don't even file it, because often one can forget where one filed it. The Bible itself will bring these questions up repeatedly enough that we won't have a chance to ignore them. The same question as to God's methods will come up through the whole Bible, even to the last book in the Bible. Why, when you're saying give the gospel to the whole world, do you talk about fire and brimstone in the third angel's message there right at the very end in Revelation 14:12? Why do you do that? So we'll not escape that question, but let's save it and see if more evidence comes as we go along. Thinking of use of power, what about using power to appoint the Levites to be the priests? And there's the whole story of Aaron's rod that budded. It would be very nice to know after an election that this is definitely God's choice. So they knew, because of the miracle of the rod that budded and even had fruit on it, that the Levites were to be selected. Is that method used elsewhere in the Bible? is it dropped in New Testament times. When Judas died, they had to pick a disciple to take his place. And you remember they cast lots. It's the same basic method. Then if this method is used both in the Old and the New Testament, why do we read of churches having elections? Why don't we read of them asking for signs? Why don't we use that same method?
Good question.
And it goes along, you see, with the same idea. Why are we using different methods from the methods used in the scriptures? Because fortunately, when it came to choosing the disciples, they chose two of the best men they could nominate to the Lord, and they prayed earnestly for help, and they used their customary method of casting lots. And the lot fell on, it doesn't say it fell on the one the Lord wanted. Either one would have been good, but it could well have, because is there evidence that God uses methods that the people are accustomed to and even blesses them in using those methods? So I would assume it fell on the disciple that the Lord wanted. The fact that God uses a method, seems to bless a certain method in biblical times, does that endorse it as an appropriate method at the present time? Yes.
The other thing that went through my mind is that if they'd had a popularity contest to see who would lead them, I'm sure Moses would not have won. I mean, they just got rid of Korah, Nathan, and Abiram, and I suspect they would go after more popular people who wouldn't have been able to do anything like Moses had done for them. So God had to step in and do something as far as the Levites and Aaron, and in essence solidifying Moses' position. Because if we went to a popular vote, Moses wouldn't have won.
Well, speaking of Moses, God's announcement to him that he could not go in with the people into the promised land for some presumably very important reason is a very good story to balance with some of these other methods. It indicates how God prefers to relate to people. For example, now much of this is going to be in Deuteronomy coming up the next time, but in Deuteronomy 1:37, the event having occurred in Numbers 20, and perhaps to refresh one's memory, you remember the people grumbled that there was no water. And God said to Moses, "Speak to the rock and give the people water." Now Moses was very angry with the people. They were grumbling so, and they were so ungrateful, that when God said, "Just speak to the rock, and they'll have all the water that they want," Moses smote the rock and made that memorable speech, "You ungrateful wretches, must we bring forth water from this rock?" And water did come forth. But God said to Moses, "Because you did not honor me or hold me up as holy before the people, you may not take the people into the promised land." And Moses begged and begged, and finally God says, "Speak to me no more of this matter." Now, much of this is coming up in Deuteronomy, but just a verse or two for today in Deuteronomy. In 1:37, there's mention made, "Not even you, Moses, will enter the land." And Moses complains to the people, "Because of you, the Lord also became angry with me." Because of the people. Then look at 3:23. In Deuteronomy, "At that time I earnestly prayed, 'Sovereign Lord, I know that you have shown me only the beginning of the great and wonderful things you are going to do. There is no God in heaven or on earth who can do the mighty things that you have done. Let me cross the Jordan River, Lord, and see the fertile land on the other side, the beautiful hill country and the Lebanon mountains. But because of you people, the Lord was angry with me and would not listen. Instead, he said, 'That's enough. Don't mention this again.'" And you remember the rest of the account there. And then in chapter 34, of course we should probably look at this again when we're doing Deuteronomy, in 34 verse 1, "So Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Mount Pisgah east of Jericho, and there the Lord showed him the whole land," and so on. But he was not allowed to go in. He says, "I have let you see it, but I will not let you go there." Verse 4 of Deuteronomy 34. Now, the people who had behaved so miserably during the 40 years, when presumably the Lord was developing a new generation who would behave better than their forefathers, they were to be taken into the promised land. But Moses, who had simply apparently become very impatient and irritated with the people because he smote the rock instead of speaking to it, it would appear, is not to go into the promised land. Why does God seem to be holding them to different standards? Yes.
When I was reading this, I can understand why Moses would get mad. What they were really saying in Numbers 20 is, oh, that we had died like Korah, Nathan, and Abiram. That the Lord had, why didn't the Lord swallow us also in front of the tent like he did them? Which, just reading it, made me upset. And I'm sure if I was Moses and had 40 years of it, that would have been beyond human endurance, in my opinion. So I'm seconding your question.
Was it the only time that Moses misrepresented God this way? Was this the first one time?
Well, you remember at the beginning we read of him getting very irritated with them because of their complaints about the food. He said, God, if you're going to make me have to look after them, I'd just assume you kill me and let me have my rest. Does God ever talk like that? Well, he did at times say to Moses, I am sick and tired of these people. Step aside and let me destroy them, and I'll make a great nation of you. And Moses is the one then who sounds more godlike and says, but God, if you were to do this, the heathen would hear of it, you'd lose your reputation, and I wouldn't want you to hurt your reputation. And there Moses is defending God in a very godly manner. How to put all of these together? Well, much of this is coming up in Deuteronomy. What's so striking in Numbers, though, about this story is the relationship that God had with Moses that was so close that it makes God's denial of Moses, the privilege of going into Canaan, the more striking. And that's in the 12th chapter when it says God was angry with Miriam and Aaron. Moses had married a Cushite woman, and Miriam and Aaron criticized him for it. They said, has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Hasn't he also spoken through us? The Lord heard what they said. Now, Moses was a humble man, more humble than anyone else on earth. Now, I grew up reading the King James as a small boy, and that says he was the meekest man on earth. And that used to trouble me even as a small boy, because I understood you weren't supposed to brag about any virtues you might have, particularly a rather spiritual one like this. Be like the Pharisee who said, I thank thee, I'm not like this publican over here, this sinner. And Moses was the meekest man who ever lived. Until as I grew older, I realized that people are not particularly respectful of meekness. In fact, Jesus, who is known as gentle Jesus, meek and mild, was not admired for his meekness by many. In, say, an election in the United States, have you ever heard of a presidential candidate referring to his meekness as a qualification that commended him for election? We tend to think of meek people as wimps, a word that was used in recent elections. So for Moses to say to people who did not respect meekness, I'm not ashamed to tell you, I'm the meekest man on earth, took a lot of humility, but I didn't recognize that early on. You don't brag to most people about being meek. But then Jesus comes along and says, blessed are the meek. Not the weak, but the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Well, then, suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, I want the three of you to come out to the tent of my presence. They went, and the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud, stood at the entrance of the tent, and called out, Aaron, Miriam. Can you imagine Dana being in school, and the principal says, I want you, Dana, and your two friends to come to the principal's office. And you three walk in and you stand there. And the principal says, now, Dana and so-and-so, you step forward. I want to talk to you specially. How would you be feeling?
Well, first of all, I'd go, what did I do?
Isn't that right? That's what I would do. What did I do? I wonder what I did.
I would probably, at first, I'd be freaking out. And yes. I'd kind of be fiddling with my clothes and looking down. And then I'd find out what I had done. And
yes.
Depends on what.
And it's interesting what happens here. The two of them step forward, and the Lord said, now hear what I have to say. Wish we had a tape of that. I'd like to know what the voice sounds like. When there are prophets among you, I reveal myself to them in visions and speak to them in dreams. It is different when I speak with my servant Moses. Note he calls him servant, also calls him friend. There's nothing wrong with being a servant. We'd love to hear the words of the Lord, well done, thou good and faithful servant. It's just that Jesus said, I'd rather no longer call you my servants. I'd rather call you my friends. Because most people think that to be a good servant, you just do what you're told without understanding. It's good to be a servant. Christ knelt and washed a dozen pairs of dirty feet like a servant. There's nothing wrong with being a servant. But because to be a friend means you'd be free to ask questions and you would want to understand, he said, I would rather treat you as friends. It is different when I speak with my servant Moses, who in Exodus is called God's friend, remember. I have put him in charge of all my people Israel. So I speak to him face to face, clearly, and not in riddles. Now that's Good News Bible. In the King James it said, in dark speeches. Let me check my New Revised Standard of 1989 and see what they have for that. Do you have any other translation here today? We're all good news. All right, let me see. Here's the New Revised Standard of 1989. With him I speak face to face clearly, and they've adopted riddles now. In the previous, in the Revised Standard, I believe they still had dark speech. Dark speech. I rather like dark speech. It's so very colorful. Because Jesus is going to refer to this later on when he talks to the disciples in the upper room about being his friends rather than acting like trembling servants. Clearly and not in riddles. He has even seen my form. How dare you speak against my servant Moses? So they had a very remarkable relationship and could talk very clearly. As, for example, when God said, step aside, let me destroy the people, look how Moses talked back. Now, an understanding of what it would be like to talk to God face to face as a friend. Over in John 16, just before Jesus goes out to die, and right after he has said in John 15, I would rather call you my friends because I want you to understand. He then says in John 16, say starting with verse 25, I have used figures of speech to tell you these things. That's the same dark speech. But the time will come when I will not use figures of speech. Other versions have parables, metaphors, symbols, but will speak to you plainly about the Father. Now, certainly there's an obvious similarity between these remarks and what he's saying about Moses in Numbers 12. When that day comes, you will ask him in my name, and I do not say that I will ask him on your behalf, for the Father himself loves you. Very simple words there about God. And this is right after God has been talking to Moses about having someone in between, a mediator, an intercessor, and Moses being that one. And the people had begged for someone in between. And here he says, now I can talk to you plainly about my Father. There really is no need for that. The Father loves you as much as I do. So the question was raised a while ago, how would God rather work with us? Now, most of the time he's had to work with us as rebels. Much of the time he's had to work with us as very immature, irresponsible children who've needed a lot of discipline. But even with prophets, it says, he talks to them in visions and symbols and metaphors, and the Bible is full of that kind of thing. But he says, when I have a real friend, I don't have to talk in dark speech. I can talk plainly, simply, and clearly, and say such extraordinary things as, when I deal with you, I don't need anyone in between. I can deal directly with you, and you can pray directly to me. Now he says, Jesus said, do pray to the Father in my name. But what would that mean? That if we've just finished a lovely prayer and the Lord is just about to tell the angels, that's the nicest prayer I've ever heard, go down and grant those requests, and we forget to end with in his name, and God says, cancel that whole out. You're supposed to end that way. You know God would not do that. It's just that if Jesus had not come to be the bridge builder, the mediator, the intercessor, the one between, to let us know what God is like, we might not even want to approach him. We wouldn't know how to approach him. We certainly wouldn't know that we could approach him as a friend and even ask questions like Job. You remember those four other saints thought he was wrong. And Elihu said, I wouldn't ask to talk to God the way you are, Job. I wouldn't give him a chance to kill me. Those are the words of the crowds at the foot of Sinai. Don't let God speak to us, lest we die. So when you have that attitude toward God, then he cannot talk to you plainly and clearly the way he could to Moses, who was his friend. Now, significantly, you remember back in Exodus, when the people were terrified by God's emergency measures of thunder and lightning and power and so on, Moses understood why he was doing that. And he said, there really is no need to be afraid. Because, you see, Moses was God's friend. And I like to think that those of us who have accepted that invitation and wish to be God's plain-speaking friends, certainly to ourselves and to the members of our families and to others we may know, we could help explain. And so when they read a story and it seems rather terrifying, we could say, you know, there really is no need to be afraid. Or when they're saying, I wouldn't ask to speak to God like that, I wouldn't give him a chance to kill me, you could say, well, you really can. Plus, all this dark speech that has, I think, weighed down religious discourse through the centuries. I mean, the vocabulary of theology is extraordinary. I mean, to be a really well-trained theologian, one has to almost learn a foreign language. The terms, well, so many of them come from Latin sources. It certainly helps to know Latin if you want to be a theologian, if just to understand the terms, let alone the old literature of the fathers and so on. Most people sitting in the pews don't understand those terms, even though when the preacher may use them, he may get a fine response of amens from the audience because they've heard those gorgeous words once again. But if you ask the members, do you know what that word means? Often they don't. Of course, I love to ask the pastor, that word you use, do you know what it means? You know, should be very polite when doing that. And since I had the privilege of teaching biblical languages to many, many hundreds of pastors, I'm not afraid to make the observation that some of them really don't know the meaning of those terms, but they're the right words to use. I have heard someone preach on the word propitiation, and he doesn't know what it came from. That's why I had a burden to teach biblical languages to future preachers, so they would understand what those words mean, because often the dark speech is not that dark in the Bible. It's much plainer in the Bible, much plainer.
That's true.
And that's why these lovely translations are such a blessing to us. I know there are some folk who are very worried about all these translations, and we perhaps should only use the good old King James. The King James Version Committee, they were in favor of these translations. There used to be a wonderful preface called The Translators to the Reader at the front of the King James Version. I wish it was still in there. It's in the language of the day, which shows that the language of the King James was not a sacred language. It's the way everybody talked. Mm-hmm. You addressed the garbage man, and I prithee, thou faithful garbage man, that thou wilt put the rubbish in yonder vessel. That's the way they talked all the time. But in the preface, there is the most eloquent defense of a variety of versions. And the King James Committee did not say, do away with all the other versions. Make generous use of them, and they're all the Word of God. So it's such a contradiction for a defender of the King James to decry the other versions, for that was not the spirit, anyway, of the committee that produced the King James. Words like propitiation, that's a translation word, and many others like it. The word justify, that's a Latin-based word. The original word may not be nearly that complicated, and it isn't, in my opinion. So the relationship between God and Moses was extraordinary. They could talk very plainly, and there were times when Moses really defended God. So perhaps we should leave that to Deuteronomy, because that's where God says what his mistake was. He doesn't mention that you just disobeyed me. He did something of much greater harm and greater consequence, and God goes on record as to what that is. Well, what about Balaam? Realize we haven't done enough about Moses. To me, the most significant thing in Numbers is his relationship with Moses. And why Moses, having done so little? He didn't steal anything? I mean, apparently, what did he do that was wrong? Could not go into the promised land, whereas those grumbling people could. What about his treatment of Balaam? Please, may I curse your people? And God says, absolutely not. And having been taught in many a sermon, you should persevere in prayer. He prayed again, Lord, may I curse your people? The Lord said the answer is the same, no. But he persevered in prayer. A lot of people pray until they get what they want. Mm-hmm. And he said, may I curse your people? And this time the Lord said, yes, you may, but you must use the message which I will give you, which turned out to be the prediction of the star that led the wise men to Bethlehem. So the number of things in there, Why would God use a man like Balaam to predict that wonderful event, the birth of the Lord in Bethlehem? Why would he use a man like that? What would that say about God?
I marvel that God talked to him at all, because if we read further, we find out that Balaam then gives a suggestion to Balak to send the women of Moab into the camp, and that's the way you'll get what you want. He really ended up harpooning the Israelites after all.
He was a traitor.
Absolutely.
He really was. An evil one. Then why would God deal with him?
And another question is, why didn't Balaam get his eyes open when the donkey started talking to him to realize that maybe this wasn't the smart thing to do? And the angel says, I would have killed you, but your donkey saved your life three times. It leads me to think that Balaam was bent on getting the riches and the place in the kingdom, and let all else fall where it may.
I realized the issue wasn't the donkey. On the other hand, were donkeys talking frequently back then? You'd think that Balaam would have really sat up and taken notice.
Do you recall whether donkeys have a reputation for making good sense? Or don't we usually refer to them in some other way? And
I mean, to read this story is I mean, there is a touch of humor in it. I can't
think
imagine
so.
Anybody reading the story and not sitting there marveling, going, I think I might have paid a little attention.
That donkey showed more sense than Balaam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was insane that he would ask God, may I curse your people? A donkey'd know better than that. And then in the end, you notice how he died in that battle. It's a very sorry end. And yet, God used him. Has he used several other quite unsavable people in the biblical record? Do you think he still does?
He had one close to him while he walked this earth, Judas.
Did Judas do anything good?
Yes. I mean, I'm sure in deeds and actions, as far as what, let's put it this way, the disciples thought he was doing good.
He was their treasurer, had an important position.
I mean, there's certain things in function that you can perhaps do that looks like a good deed, but
he didn't directly choose Judas, you remember. The other disciples recommended him because he was very skillful with money, and that's often
but it did show that God didn't discard him, even though he wanted to join.
Let him come.
Mm-hmm. That he...
Did he know what he was going to do? Did Jesus know he was going to betray him? It's mentioned, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think God knew that Balaam was going to do all this? And God went through with it all, put it in the record, and it's supposed to say something to us of consequence. And what God wants most is that we trust him. How would this encourage us to trust him?
One thing is for certain, God does not circumvent events to manipulate them to come out in his favor, because even though he did put words in Balaam's mouth, again, I come back to the point, he never stopped Balaam from giving a suggestion to Balak that ended up doing the job that Balaam couldn't do in the first place. So God still allowed him freedom, even after, I would say, profound evidence to the contrary, to continue going down his pathway. And in no way infringed upon his choice, free will choice.
Thinking of any other stories in the Bible where God even chose somebody and used him for good purposes for a while, and in the end, how about King Saul? He wound up consulting the dead in behalf of the living, and a suicide, and yet God chose him and gave him to the people. Do you think these stories are very clear to the angels as they watch? God, why would you choose Balaam? If you beg God long enough for something, will he let you have it, even if it's not good for you? By the way, did Balaam say, if it be according to your will? When Jesus was here, he said, nevertheless, your will be done. He didn't do that. Usually in the story, we become preoccupied with the donkey, that God would do this miraculous thing. And it is interesting that he used the donkey, who seemed to be paying more attention to what the Lord had to say than Balaam himself. I'm just particularly impressed that he would use a man like that, a rascal like that, to predict the greatest event, you know, the arrival of the Messiah, born as a baby. Can you think in your own life, don't mention any names, of course, of anybody that has given a wonderful message, even pictured God wonderfully, and in the end, his life has been a total shipwreck? Why would God allow them to give this good message? Of course, Lucifer was originally the morning star, the light bearer, and he became an enemy. I find it encouraging, too, that God would use somebody like that. So would he be willing to use us? Not that we have to end the way Balaam did, but God is willing to use people. Or could we get along perfectly well without the Balaam story? Why does it occupy important space here in this book?
Well, I find it encouraging all the way throughout the Bible that it seems like everyone can find little bits and pieces of themselves, which seems to give you hope. And, you know, obviously you don't want to focus on someone whose end did not come to very good. But you realize that God is working with humanity, and and if you'd listen, you do have a chance.
Well, they give Balaam every chance. I mean, he went beyond the call of duty to try to get through to this man.
Yes.
And that maybe is an illustration of probably an example of what he does for all of us. Maybe we don't see it in such striking terms, but I would imagine he would do the same for us as he's done for Balaam.
Well, it's like Judas in the upper room when Jesus knelt and washed his dirty feet. Wouldn't you think that would have touched him? Maybe it did momentarily, but he went out and betrayed him. When Balaam realized that God was using him for a very important message, wouldn't you think that would have touched him at the time? But it didn't. I also like to think when it comes time to pray, often we in our prayers are almost suggesting to the Lord what we think the response ought to be from heaven, you know. This is what I want. This is what I want. And you may not get it right away, so you go back and say, this is what I want. He never said, Lord, tell me if I am asking for the right thing. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Lord had indicated, you're not even asking me for the right thing. It seems to me a lot of prayer is really not teachable prayer. Saying, Lord, this is what I think I want, but let me know if I really should want something else. And if we persist, sometimes the Lord will say, all right, I will let you have what you're praying for, and you may learn something from it. But I'm not going to abandon you right off, and I'll work with you as I did with Balaam. And in the end, Balaam was impossible. God does look good and generous, doesn't he, through the whole story? It seems that the worse the people are that God works with, the better he looks through it all. And he's willing to go to any lengths, even that incredible story with the donkey. Anything else in Numbers that impresses you particularly?
This isn't something that impresses me, but I was wondering, if you want people to read the Bible and, you know about it, then why have all these numbers listed? Because it's a turnoff to me. I mean, and then having little teeny stories in between, so you accidentally will skip over them. Why not just put in one book, have all the stories, and, you know, make them interesting, you know, really, don't exaggerate, but, you know, make it interesting and put them right after one another. And then in another book for people who want to know the facts, just put all the information they put in here, because you're flipping through going numbers, 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 numbers. I mean, I don't really care how many people there were in this tribe and this year and this area and how many animals they had, you know. Well, I just...
At least it could be put in the back, in the appendix. If you want to do research, you can read it all back there. If all of that was taken out and put at the back, then we could read through with greater interest, you're suggesting.
How many people older than 12 do you think have ever thought this?
This is why many people get very discouraged just after reading two or three books in the Old Testament. The New Year's resolution, I'm going to read the Bible through next year. This is why so many people know Genesis very well. Because they do get started.
And then, Matthew.
And Matthew in the New Testament. I think it's a very fair question. Why put all those details in there? And there are a lot of other details, too, even in the middle of a story. It'll mention so many little details about the whole situation. And in the middle of it is a gem of thought. Why not just put the gems in there and skip all the details?
I think maybe God should have told Moses something more like, now tell these stories, put them, don't say, and then Issachar went to Issachar and said these exact words to go at this hour. with this family who had this many members complete, and you want to go, why not just put that stuff back, have a list like a family tree of the Bible or something, and then just tell the story so that people, it would be so much easier, and it would cut the Bible down a little bit so it wouldn't sound so, wow.
Well, a scholar who did as much as anybody who's ever lived to make the Bible readable to people was Dr. Edgar J. Goodspeed. And it was because of his great reputation that I chose to go to the University of Chicago to study, and his field was New Testament. He was known as the greatest living scholar of biblical and patristic Greek. But I saw him one day, downtown Chicago, right off State Street, in the Fair Store, which is not one of the more expensive stores. It's the kind of store people would go into right off the street who didn't have too much to spend. And he was lecturing to them on a book he'd just written on how to read the Bible. And he made it so simple everybody could understand. His whole goal was to make the Bible readable. And he translated the New Testament into what was called the American Translation. Did it back in 1923. Still one of the very best. Well, here was a man dedicated to encouraging people to read the Bible. And he raised your question. And so he produced what became known as the Shorter Bible. And he left out a lot of those things. But if you had sat down with Dr. Goodspeed, and he was a very sociable gentleman, he had trouble with his eyesight the last many years of his life, and so he was advised not to write or study at night, but rather he would open his home to the students at the University of Chicago, especially the Divinity School students, and they could visit with him at length, and he would talk with them. And if you were to ask him, does that mean you don't attach any importance to all those numbers and genealogies? Oh, no, he would say. It's just that the average reader perhaps gets tired of reading all that sort of thing. But he said, if you really want to recreate the whole history and setting within which God chose to do this or that, or say this or that, you need every detail you can lay your hands on. And those genealogies that talk about the family lines provide a great deal of useful information. Historians would be very sorry to lose all of that. But then what about the beginning reader? We haven't talked much about versions of the Bible, but a modern gentleman by the name of Dr. Taylor was concerned that his children were having difficulty understanding the Bible, and so he paraphrased it. That is to say, he took the biblical words and put them in very simple, everyday language, sometimes with a certain amount of freedom. And he called it the Living Bible. When he was through, nobody wanted to print it because it was so free. And so he printed 2,000 copies himself and thereby started one of the most extraordinary publishing ventures in the history of Christianity. It's a long time ago that he has sold 30 million copies. And people love to read the Living Bible, because it has been made so easy to read. So if you were to go to God and say, God, this is hard reading, he would want it to be easy. I wonder what he'd advise. Would he say, skip the numbers and skip the genealogies and so on, and wait until the right time? And I think then when you read through, don't linger too long in the middle of one of those genealogies, you know, and say, my, that's strange spelling, and so on. No, note what's in there and read on, and someday you may want to come back when there's reference to somebody later in the Bible and say, I remember he was mentioned way back here. You'd be surprised how much important historical detail is in those lists. And then as far as the numbers are concerned, and other little details about, well, almost everything, all the little details. If we didn't have all those little details, we couldn't recreate the whole setting within which God chose to act in a certain way and speak in a certain way. We would just listen to the words he spoke and say, why did you do that? He says, well, read all around it and you'll see how the people were behaving. Like, Jean, you mentioned how they were behaving like little irresponsible children coming out of Egypt. You see all these little indications. So I found the older I get and the more I learn, the more I appreciate every one of those little details. There was a day when I found the genealogies rather hard going. So lay them aside for the moment, and someday they may seem much more significant. When we get to the birth of Christ, you'll find two genealogies, and they're different. Christ's ancestors in Matthew and Christ's ancestors in Luke, and they don't read the same. You say, my, that's very interesting. and you begin to compare them with some of the Old Testament genealogies. Well, any other main thing in Numbers? Actually, it carries right into Deuteronomy, especially this main thing about why God would keep his best friend out of the Promised Land. And perhaps then we could end with that and go right into it in Deuteronomy next time.